Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Oh, you hear that? We have a very large live audience for today's show, and I'm really, really happy for it. And we have guests for you. As you listen into the show today, I hope you'll call in because we've got a couple of guests to start the show to answer questions about indoor or outdoor plants. Welcoming back Bruce Spangenberg, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. Bruce, good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
And with us for the first time is Erica Hanekel. She is the author, former professor of environmental history at Northland College. And Erica, great to have you with us for the first time.
Thanks so much, Larry. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And as we move along today, I do hope you'll join in with your questions as well. Our live audience, folks will be raising their hands. But you can call if you're listening in. Easy to do. Call 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bruce, Erica, I want to hear a bit more about your professional backgrounds. Bruce, you're closest to me, so we'll start with you. You're a transplant from our neighbor of the South, Illinois. What'd you do there?
Actually, I'm not a train. I worked there, but I lived in Wisconsin.
Good.
I crossed the border every day. Most of my career was in Illinois. I actually had retired a few years ago and then was looking for something to do horticulture-wise, and this opportunity came along in Iron County with UW Extension. But I had been with University of Illinois Extension in Northern Illinois, the Northern Counties. I started in a county job in McHenry County, and then I was a regional horticulture educator across almost the northern third of the state. And then second half of my career, I was the horticulture department chair and instructor at McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois. So I taught credit courses, you know, advised students, ran the program, that kind of thing.
So a lot of experience there. And Erica, you certainly had a lot of experience too. Talk about your work in environmental history. I found that very fascinating.
Sure, yeah. So my gardening credentials, I've been a master gardener here in Wisconsin for 16 years, 15 years maybe.
Yeah.
And I was a professor of environmental history for 16 years mostly within the U.S., talking about humans' interaction with their environment over the long arc of U.S. history. But I also offer classes in agricultural history and horticultural history. I've also written two books. My latest is Orchid Muse. That was perhaps the most fun project that I have ever embarked on in my life. My previous book, my first book, was called Empire of Vines, and it was a history of 19th century wine growing.
Well, you know, and I like the subtitle to that second book, A History of Obsession.
Yes, of orchids, yes. I guess
flowers.
You could obsess about wine, too, but yes.
So as we go along, maybe I'm going to talk with you a little bit more about that obsession, but orchids certainly are on your mind a lot. So orchid questions. Actually, we'll take any question that you have relating to your both indoor and outdoor flowers. Bruce, how's the spring been for growing up here?
The rain is nice.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, one of the things, though, I think a misconception a lot has happened a lot in questions I've got the last couple months. We had a mild winter, but it actually was pretty harsh on plants because we didn't have snow. We didn't get much moisture at all. So we had a lot of damage going back to last year that carried into winter. So. You know, a nice snow cover protects a lot of things, and you don't have it, you know, you do run into problems. But the spring's been good. We've got rain.
People planting a little earlier?
Yeah, but, you know, we've had how many frost advisories in the last 6 weeks? I mean, it's tempting, but, yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine the flowers are probably okay, but you don't want to be putting your, people were putting their tomatoes and peppers out early. That would not
especially, I mean, you know, March and April were pretty mild and people, you know, you want to get out there and do things, but you really need to, you know, we're okay now, but you know, tomatoes in the first week of May is pretty risky. Peppers in May is pretty risky.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, Erica, lots of gardeners are planting native plants.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And talk about the benefits of adding natives to your landscape.
Yeah. So for me, I have kind of a long list of my favorite ornamental natives, mm-hmm. because I live on a fairly small plot in town. And so I kind of garden it to the hilt, but I want to combine as many natives as I possibly can to keep our pollinator population up. But I am not exclusive. I mm-hmm. also do other hybridized ornamental plants. I'm kind of a take it all kind of person. For me, the attraction to the bees is kind of number one. I mean, the beauty of the form of particular native plants here in northern Wisconsin as well. So one of my absolute favorites would be bottle gentian. It grows about 3 feet high. I do stake it a bit because it wants to flop, but as long as it's getting enough water and quite a bit of sun, it produces these gorgeous sort of lavender, sort of a bottle worth of flowers mm-hmm. on each thing. And the bees sort of like buzz their cute little butts all the way into and the flower collapses upon them. Oh. And then they come back out. And so you can just sit by it and you just like watch this little town worth of bees that has come to your garden. You know, there's lots of other very beneficial things for it, you know, of course, for soil chemistry and health as well. I mean, of course, swamp milkweed and other types of milkweed, but at least in my garden, the easiest and the most frequented would be swamp milkweed, and those would be for the butterflies, so that is caterpillar food. And then if you add one other plant to somewhere in the vicinity that is not native to here, but it is native to North America, if you add Tithonia, or what's called Mexican sunflower, then what you've got is a lovely kind of a double dip here, because the Tithonia is feeding the actual butterflies, and then they go to the milkweed and lay their eggs, and then the caterpillars eat the milkweed. And so you have a full buffet for the full life cycle of the butterflies there.
You know, I want to jump up and drive over and take a look at your...
Please do. Please do.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. Yeah. So you've given a lot of thought to that.
I try to do some landscaping with perennials or ornamental native perennials. You know, the other ones that are really beautiful to me, I love doll's eyes, or what's called white baneberry. It looks creepy. It is definitely creepy. If you are sort of on the dark side of things, you want to grow doll's eyes for sure. And this is a really good one for partial shade. Because I live in town, I have a whole lot of shade, and so I think a lot more about shade than about sun. But it grows into, I don't know, a 2 or 3 foot bush, and it has beautiful spires of very sort of light, airy white flowers. But then it produces this bud, or this, it looks like a big seed, which I guess it is, on the end of the sort of panicle of its flowers. And it's just these like bright white sort of berry-looking things with little black eyeballs coming out of it. And so it just looks like this stalk of eyeballs coming at you. My son loves it, but I will say it is also toxic, so you don't want to grow it where small fingers can pick it and would want to put it in their mouths. You probably don't want to grow it around chickens or other pets.
Oh, well, so it would be a problem for birds, too?
I don't think it's a problem for birds, although the birds definitely leave it alone in my yard. I've never had anything come after it.
Yeah, they tend to be smarter than we are when it comes to
yeah,
comes
yeah, to, they do.
to things like that, for sure. Well, Mark had sent us an email and wonders if one or both of you could please name some common riverbank plants distinguishing between good and bad. Well, what do you think, Bruce?
Riverbank as far as what to plant or what to...
I think the person's probably interested in what are some plants we could put along our riverbank, and then what are some we shouldn't put?
Yeah. Well, I think if you stick with the native plant theme, something like little bluestem, you know, wouldn't grow in the water, but would help stabilize the banks. As with most grasses, little bluestem, even big bluestem. You could also go with, if you want to go with a good low maintenance plant, you know, the fragrant sumacs, the low grow sumac in particular, that's only 18 inches high or something, is a good stabilizer. There's always that fine line when you deal with stabilizing soil with plants that do a very good job, but then get into the invasive side, and that's where things like ribbon grass in the past, blue lyme grass is another one that if you go back in time was widely recommended because it had a really aggressive rhizome system that would stabilize the bank. It still had an ornamental value, but now it's no longer legal to sell because it's invasive.
So. Yeah, so stay away from that. Well, talking with Bruce Bagenberg, a UW Extension horticulture educator for Iron County, and Erica Hanekel, who is a master gardener, author, he's got a couple of books out, former professor of environmental history at Northland College. You can join in, audience, as if somebody wants to raise their hand for a question. We've got some. You can join in by phone at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. But let's take a question from the audience. And your name is?
My name is Naomi Wegmeyer. And we have a large organic vegetable garden. It was inundated by grasshoppers last summer. And I am wondering, can I expect the same awful thing this year? Because they were just, I've never seen it like that before.
The short answer is no. You can't really predict from year to year, even though it was terrible last year. You know, same thing with Japanese beetles and other things. So people say, I'm overrun. But a lot of factors can come into play, and the winter is one of them. You know, the fact we had no snow does influence insects, not necessarily in a good way. But the other thing is moisture. You know, grasshoppers tend to thrive better in dry weather. So now we've had a pretty wet start to this season. So what happens with a lot of insect populations, they do have controls. There are natural fungi and bacteria that actually, you know, keep the populations down. But in a dry year, they're not present. So it's anyone's guess. There's really nothing you can do to, ahead of time to prevent them from coming back. You're pretty much at the mercy of the conditions and, the weather, what happens.
There you go. You can join in too. Again, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting from Bayfield, the Bayfield Pavilion for Bayfield in Bloom. We're celebrating that a bit, but certainly we're talking about those flowers and indoor and outdoor. We're taking a look at vegetables. We covered that a little bit too. You can join in. Maybe you've got a question. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we have a question from the audience.
Hi, my name's Ann Christensen, and I'm from Washburn. And I think it's kind of an insect question, but we have a very small apple and pear orchard, and our best pollinators in early spring are wasps. And they're very friendly wasps. They don't go after you unless you really dig into their nests. And so we welcome them and appreciate them. But my question is, I've heard that they lay their eggs in caterpillars. And so I'm wondering, I hope they're not also laying their eggs in monarch caterpillars, which we try very hard to support.
They might, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It depends, and that's an excellent question, because there are a number of wasps that are parasitic, and they tend to be very host-specific, so there may be a certain one that does seek out a monarch, but on the other hand, there's others that seek out other pests. But most of these wasps are really, really small, but they are kind of fascinating because they will find their host. And probably the best examples, I'm sure some of you have seen, if you grow tomatoes, you get the tomato hornworm that has these big, that look like eggs, they're white. Those are actually cocoons of the parasitic wasp that are gonna emerge. So if you see that, leave it alone, because that's gonna create another couple dozen wasps to go around and find more hornworms. But the short answer to your question, it's hard to say, because most of those parasitic wasps are very specific to the host that they seek out.
Yeah, and a follow-up?
My name is Stacy Corcoran. I moved up to Ashland last summer, and I moved into a house that had some dying pine trees. We immediately cut them off. We're grinding the stumps down to ground level. So my question is kind of two-faceted. One is, will I ruin everything if I put stump disintegrator on those stumps? And the other question is, if I want to layer material over that so I can make that area plantable, what layers would you recommend?
So you ground the stumps out, or you're...
Two are gone, one is going to go in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. I mean, you're pretty much, you can, you know, add whatever amendments you'd like, level it off, and then plant what you like. There are very few restrictions on replacing plants, or, you know, replanting an area where a tree died or a shrub died or whatever. So I would just make sure whatever's left after they ground out the stump, you add some soil to that, level it off, make sure it's firm, and then just plant, you know, whatever you want to plant in that area. There shouldn't be any lingering concerns.
I wouldn't think so.
I might suggest trying to remove as much of the wood as possible, just because it'll suck the nitrogen out of anything else you try to put there. So if you could dig it out, I don't think the stump disintegrator is going to be a problem, because that's just more of a sort of natural bacteria that's breaking that down. And at least when I have tried that, it doesn't work very fast. And it sounds like you want pretty quick turnover, so it might just be better to just get a shovel and kind of like lift it out of there.
Yeah, good question. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. So I want to just go back to last year for a minute. As you saw the end of the season, I mean, how did the season go in northern Wisconsin?
I think the biggest issue was drought. And then the problem with that, a lot of people overlooked that, you know, you look at what happens with plants this spring, you say, well, the winter was mild, we got rain, you know, why did my plant, and we see this with shrubs, we see it with trees, I know a couple growers that have had problems with raspberries too, that they start to leaf out and then they just shrivel up, and you're wondering, well, what happened? Well, a lot of it goes back, with any perennial plant, goes back to the previous year, and if they don't store up enough energy because of drought or because of an insect problem, whatever it might have been, they go into winter weak, and then they need a lot of energy to come out of dormancy in the spring. So a lot of times what happens is there's enough energy to start the bud break, the leaves start to come out, and then the plant literally runs out of energy and it just dries up. So your hope is the roots are still alive, depending on, you know, with raspberries, that's usually the case, but many times with trees or shrubs, you end up with dieback that you have to go in now and prune it out.
Yeah.
In my case, the drought created something that I had never experienced before. So I have many raised beds in my backyard and my front yard for the past 15 years or so. And I had never had root creep from trees around into the raised beds, because I had been watering the raised beds so that my vegetables would grow throughout the drought. And all the maples that are 40, 50 feet away just took over everything. And so we've had to basically excavate the entire bed, pull out all the roots.
And start over?
And, I mean, we put the soil back in, and they might come back, you know, I'm sure they'll come back any other super dry year, hoping for a little more rain this year so they don't invade again quite as quickly.
Where are we on rain this year for northern Wisconsin? We certainly got it in the south.
I think short term, we've caught up, but I'm not sure. If you look at different drought monitors that go back, you know, where are we with 12 months or 18 months? I'm not sure, but I think we're pretty close. It is somewhat localized, though. Sometimes, you know, some of you will say, nothing, you know, we got a little shower, and you talk to someone else a few miles away, and they got, you know, 3/4 of an inch. So it's, some of the showers the last couple of weeks have been pretty spotty with big downpours, and then a few miles away, hardly anything. But I think we're getting back to where we should be. I don't know. There's, you know, you have to look at the total map and see.
Sure. Yeah. We have a question from the audience.
Hi, Jill Barth and Berkey from near River Falls and Hudson. We're visiting here because we have a sailboat at Port Superior. I have an organic blueberry U-pick and used to have a U-dig flower business, my husband and I. My question is, unfortunately, I purchased from a vendor tansy, which is invasive. And I just pulled a bunch of it out at Port Superior in one of the gardens because I don't like it. Although I do like the ornamental aspect of it in the fall when it dries. So is there a friendly, sustainable, organic way to eradicate tansy, or do I just keep on pulling?
I think you hit it on the head, keep on pulling. that's a good, excellent question, because when you deal with plants like that, short of using a systemic herbicide, that, you know, you just, if you're persistent and you keep cutting it, you keep, eventually the plant's going to run out of gas. Like I mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago with plants, every year they have to store up energy for the next year. And unfortunately, some of the invasive species are very good at it, but, you know, you've got rhizomes under there, you've got the crown of the plant, but if you're persistent, it, you know, you will eventually win, but it's going to take some time.
Yeah, pulling it, you're going to leave some. But
yeah, I mean,
pull
it's,
it anyway.
Right. Obviously, you like to pull it out, roots and all, but that's not practical. But if you're persistent and you keep pulling it, it doesn't have leaves to regenerate the energy it's losing. Eventually, you will kill the plant. It's just how long is eventually going to take?
Yeah.
Maybe also deeper mulch, if possible, to both protect the blueberry roots but also smother the tansy.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Very good idea. We have some more calls from the audience, questions from the audience. Jill's got another person.
Hello.
With a question.
Hello. I live in Ashland, Wisconsin here, and I went to a lovely seed exchange at the library in Washburn, and there was a woman there who had iris seeds, and I was so flabbergasted and I wanted to propagate them, but I didn't know how. Do you have any suggestions and where they would like to live?
That is, I've never done that. have you done that, Erica?
I have not started iris from seed, but I do have a few types of iris. One that is perhaps native, I think, and another that is more ornamental. They're both sort of dwarf varieties, like a foot tall or lower, and they don't want to be planted too deep. The rhizomes really actually like to have heat and sun on them in general, although the dwarf varieties can kind of move in and out of sun. I find mine are in actually partial to fairly serious shade. They also divide politely. I love things that divide politely, right? So you're not gonna have like sweeps and sweeps of them, and they're also very easy to divide because they're running on the top. You just take a sharp shovel, you know, just like crack them off and go give it to a friend or put it somewhere else in your garden.
But starting it from seed.
Yeah, I would think probably fairly thinly because the seeds
right
are quite thin as well, aren't they? They're sort of like papery thin.
I didn't understand how to do it at all.
Yeah.
And I'm not seeing anybody else raising their hand saying, hey, I did that, raised from seed. Let's take another. You know what? Somebody may call. Our calls, give us a call if you got an answer to that question, or If you have another question of your own, at 800-642-1234, and we'll get you on pretty quickly.
We have tansy and lots of it. We have an old pasture land, which has a seed bank from hell. And but when it comes to remove it mechanically, the root is L-shaped. And if you discover what direction the root goes and you pull down, most of the root will come out and it won't return. So if
you want to do a mechanical. I thought you said pansy at
tansy.
First.
Tansy. No, tansy.
Tansies too. Tansy. Okay. Thank you for that advice. Appreciate it very much. And I know we got Amy in Appleton with an email. Amy planted a climbing hydrangea about 4 years ago. It's growing wonderfully, but it's never flowered. It gets afternoon sun and is in a protected area in their front yard. It's gotten so big, moving it to a sunnier spot is no longer an option. Amy can feed it with to help it flower. Phosphorus is usually
right.
The phosphorus right. Is the feeding.
High phosphorus. Anything you can do to increase that sun just even a little bit more, if you could take down some boughs of trees at all.
Or some limbs.
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, sometimes if I will use, and I don't think this is hocus pocus, but I will use a seaweed fertilizer that has a lot of different things that are helping out roots, because if you can get that root mass super healthy and super energized, it will help the entire plant as well.
Makes good sense. We have another question from the audience now. Hi,
I'm Rose. We live down by near Cable, Wisconsin, in the woods, and we're heavily wooded with maple and oak, and we get these little maples that don't grow any bigger than maybe 6 inches. And it, on about a quarter of an acre throughout our property. And I thought I heard once that you could mow them and that would keep them back, or is there really any problem with all of those maple, as I heard the lady saying that the maple sucked up all the water, so.
I mean, you're asking you want to get rid of them?
I don't know if they're good, bad, indifferent. They're interesting that they only grow about 6 inches. And I think somebody said you can kind of mow them down. I have some spring ephemerals that like to come up, and sometimes if the maple comes up first, I can't see the ephemerals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maples will sit at a very low height until they get the opportunity to grow bigger. So they're an understory tree, so as long as there's something above them, they'll just kind of maintain themselves. And then if the tree above them disappears, then they'll shoot up and grow. So it's really a question of what you want to do. But if you want to encourage other wildflowers, then, you know, it's if you can get in there and cut them when the wildflowers aren't there, or, you know, possibly work on them in the fall a little bit. But it's part of the nature of the tree.
This is a little more labor-intensive answer, but what I do in that case is wait for a very hard, long rain so that the soil is nice and wet, and then just go pull by hand, and they come up very quickly. I mean, but if you leave them, they're fine for the forest floor. But yeah, you probably will get fewer spring ephemerals if they're all there.
I pull mine after a big rain, or I have also been known to get the hose out.
Yes. Make it easy.
And make it a little easier, for sure. We'll take another question from the audience, and then we've got some callers online with questions.
Hi, George Mashin. Just a follow-up question on the maples. I mean, I'd love to have those maples. Are those little ones easily transplantable, and how would you go about that?
Yeah, what I would do is, ideally, if you're going to transplant them, dig them up when they're small, put them in liner pots for a year or two, and then put them where you'd like. You know, one of the challenges if you plant a really small tree out in the yard, it's going to have a hard time with lawnmowers and everything else. So you got it. But yeah, I would just take a lot of those and pot them up for a year or two and then transplant them. Because what you find is once you pot them up, they grow fast. And then you can get a better tree to work with.
Let's take a call from Danelle in Madison. Danelle, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
My question is a follow-up on the nitrogen being sucked out of the soil with wood. I put in a new perennial bed last year and didn't know if it did a nice like, mulch job around the plant with wood chips. And I do have plants here, but I'm wondering if I should perhaps be supplementing some nitrogen to those
I didn't quite hear the question. I think she might have said something about mulch, wood mulch on top of the soil. As long as it's on top, it's great. That's fine. You just don't want pieces of wood or sawdust that has not been decomposed mixed in with your soil where the roots want to be, because that wood will fix the nitrogen away. Or suck it up, basically.
And even if you add some...
It might just keep taking.
It might go a little faster, might break down a little faster.
That's true, yeah.
So, there's that. Thanks, Danelle, appreciate it. Jerome in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Jerome.
Hello, I hope you can hear me all right. I just have a question. About, I have a potted jade, and there's a little mushroom body that had fruited in my pot, and I had wondered if this is a possible problem, or if it's okay if it's just a small portion.
It's perfectly fine. You can remove it, it'll be fine. It likely came in on whatever your potting soil is. Might even help out the soil ecology within that pot. You should be good to go. I this has happened to me many, many times, and it really never hurts the plant.
All right, there you go, Jerome. And let's go to Jane in Waupun. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I'm wondering if you recommend the product Preen for outdoor flower gardens.
Yeah, Preen is what we call a pre-emergent herbicide. Trifluralin is the active ingredient. And a couple things, it's an excellent question because that comes up a lot as far as using herbicides in general. The number one thing you have to look at on the label is make sure whatever plants are in the bed or the soil you're going to apply that herbicide to are on that label to make sure it's labeled. There are some vegetables, there are annuals, there are perennials on there. But also take a look at other options. Herbicides are one tool. A pre-emergent will basically what it does is it kills germinating seeds in the soil. It does not kill existing perennial weeds. But again, make sure everything's on the label as far as plants you want to keep. But also look at things like mulching, other alternatives to weed control. But in the right place, it can be a good tool. In particular, if you have a larger area where mulching maybe is not an option and you want to keep at least some of the annual weeds down, it's something you certainly can look at. And it'll last, if you put it down now, it'll last the first part of the season, give you protection against most of the annual weeds.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Well, I tell you what, we're having a lot of fun here today at the Bayfield Pavilion. A couple of great guests for us today, Bruce Bagenberg and Erica Hanekel, who have been answering questions right along and doing a wonderful job with it. If you have a question, you can join in again. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. And our audience has been doing a great job right here in front of us asking questions. And we can encourage you to continue to do that as well. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk as we broadcast from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield to celebrate Bayfield in Bloom. with a great audience here and a couple of wonderful guests as well. Bruce Bagenberg, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County, Erica Hanekel, formerly Professor of Environmental History at Northland College, Master Gardener, and author of a couple of books. So wonderful to have them with us. Questions, give us a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And we have another question from the audience. Wonderful. Thank you for your question.
My name is Lori Fox. I'm from Butternut. And I have a question about one of my perennial beds has been inundated by ants. It's surrounded by rocks. They come in through the succulents, and then they've taken over this garden. I feel like digging up the whole garden and starting over. So, ideas?
Yeah.
What do you? Well, you both might have something for us on that one. Erica, you want to start?
Yeah, my go-to for that, and this has happened a few times to me with raised beds, is the little ant stakes that you put in the soil, and you can just put, you know, a couple around the bed, and the ants come in and they take the poison that is in there and they take it back to their nest, and it goes throughout the nest. So it's very, very localized. It does not spread at all. It just goes straight into the ant nest.
Okay. Bruce?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. And the other option would be, since there are so many different kinds of ants out there, we do have an entomology diagnostic lab, insect diagnostic lab with UW Extension also, so you can work with us on that. Just to plug another thing we have Ask a Gardener online, especially for those of you in counties where we don't have horticulture or agriculture staff available. You can submit questions, you can submit pictures. So that's another option. Be if it's some unusual species of ants, maybe there's a very specific way to get rid of it.
Yeah, there we go. Let's go to Mary in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. So about 6 years ago, I was doing a healthy lake garden, and we got compost. But what got introduced were jumping worms, and we have seen what they're doing now is our actual lawn is all the grass because they feed and take the root system, and we don't know how to control it because we're just losing, our lawn.
Yeah. Oh, how devastating. I'm so sorry. At least I would suggest smothering. And what I have come to understand is that if you can get a thick plastic but see-through sheets of plastic and then staple it down, right, or use rocks to cover it, try not to let any air out, right? And so that soil will become solarized and it will kill everything like within several inches of the top of it. That's the sort of most organic way. I think that would also, if you could sort of go beyond, a little bit beyond the borders of where they are right now to try and catch any that might have escaped even further, I guess that would be my number one suggestion. How about you, Bruce?
Yeah, it's another one of our new, relatively new problems, and there's no easy answer to it. That's one option. Sometimes we're limited with the solarization, we don't get enough sun, enough warm weather to do it, but it might work. I know there are some chemical options. Again, you could go look at the specific scenario. Our horticulture website does have some information on jumping worms that might help as well. But the problem with them is they're just so aggressive in terms of decomposition compared to the native earthworms.
Yeah, the important thing is to try and keep them out to begin with. Yeah. Being careful about plants that you select, and that is really the number one thing. As you were talking, I was thinking back to my youth. I grew up in a area of southern Wisconsin where tobacco was raised for chewing tobacco and all that, and I made a lot of money cutting tobacco stalks and harvesting it, but the you know, when I was 14, 15 years old. But there were tobacco beds where they raised the tobacco plants to begin with, and before they would raise the bed, there was a couple of guys that had steamers, and they would come and steam the beds. Literally, the beds were covered, and this, I don't remember how the contraption worked, but actually the steam was in every inch of that bed. And I don't think I ever saw a tobacco bed that had a weed in it. it was really quite, and I often thought, gee, it'd be nice if we could do that on a different kind of a scale, just steaming that bed, and it didn't take that long.
Somebody needs to take that up as a business proposition.
Well, it was a long time ago, but I'm telling you, it worked. Probably still does somewhere. I'm long gone from that, but just a little side work. Let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, this is Mitch. I'm from Sun Prairie. I have dwarf lilacs, and I'm trying to figure out when is the best time to kind of trim them back and keep them under control, because I did it last year, probably at the wrong time, and didn't flower much. So when's the best time to attack them, keep them under control, to get them to flower?
Within 2 weeks when they're done blooming. So get ready.
Yep.
But that's a good point. If you wait too long, or some people, if you prune them first thing in the spring, the problem is the flower bud was formed the previous year. So if you get after them the first 2 weeks after they're done blooming, you're ahead of the game, and then the flower buds will form on the new growth, and you'll have flowers next year.
Just as an aside, for those of us, many in southern Wisconsin have already lost their lilacs, or they're well past bloom, but here in Bayfield, there are just some
peak
gorgeous
flowering,
flowering lilacs. We had a bouquet on the breakfast table this morning, and it was the brightest, best looking I could ever remember seeing. It was just beautiful.
They smell amazing.
They do indeed. Jill's raising her hand at me. We have another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Judy Reese from Bayfield. All of a sudden, we have these little, tiny, tiny little worm-like things all over the side of our house. Is this our new pest this year? What is it?
Are they furry?
Are they furry and black?
No, they're really tiny, not like the furry type.
Hard to say. I mean, spongy moth comes, what used to be called gypsy moth comes to mind, but if you're saying, if they would be black and they would have fine hairs on their body and they're gonna grow really fast, it could be something coming out of the soil. There's a good example, if you can get some pictures of it, put it up on our Ask a Gardener and one of us will look at it.
Yeah, we might have an answer within the audience. Yeah.
Our next guest, but he'll be able to, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
That's definitely the spongy moth in Bayfield right now. It's all over, and they're blowing. They're really small right now, so they're blowing in the wind and showing up all over the edges of everything. This is much heavier than last year, and last year was already a bad one.
Last year was terrible.
Was that Paul?
That's Paul.
Paul Segan, will be our guest in about 8 minutes.
There you go.
Well, hold on to your spongy moth question. Actually, I should just mention we'll be zeroing in at noon on landscape trees, fruit trees, vines. So our guests know all about that. So we'll be doing that at afternoon, after 12 o'clock, I should say. Now, go ahead. Jill has another person in the audience.
Hi, I'm Tom Mitchell. Will you speak to the health of the honeybees and the bumblebees, please?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, obviously, a lot of interest and a lot of movements in the last few years have been, pollinators in general, the Nomo May, and using pollinator plants, we've talked a little bit about, but also avoiding, especially some of the broad spectrum insecticides. In any blooming plant that you're treating for an insect pest, be, very aware of pollinators, especially honeybees and bumblebees. Some of the issues have been, mites in the hives over the winter. Those of you that are beekeepers, which I'm not, but I'm certainly well aware of those problems that with the bees, they've had a hard time overwintering because of that. But a combination of things. But you know, as a gardener, the two things you can do is plant more pollinating plants, more blooming plants, more perennial plants, and then be very careful with insecticide use. You know, look at if you have an alternative insecticide, which that's one of the things that's changed a lot. You know, I mentioned I spent most of my career in Illinois, going back quite a ways. You know, if you look at the last 30 years, insecticides available in garden centers have drastically changed from a lot of broad spectrum materials to now some that are very specific, very short-lived.
Yeah.
It's good news, bad news. It's very good news for the environment, excellent news for pollinators, but it also requires more education on the user to know what's that insecticide, what it can and can't do for you. But I don't know if that answers your question.
You would still, I mean, I would just suggest it to everyone as an environmental historian, please try to avoid neonics as much as you possibly can. Neonicotinoids are just not good for pollinators. One specific plant that I love, this is my go-to for filling shady areas that the pollinators love, all of them, I think, that also gives height and color to a shady area is Simisifugia racemosa, or it's called bugbane or black cohosh. It does really, really well in near full shade, bright reflected light. Probably can't take full sun all day long, but it will get up to, in some areas of my garden, when it's blooming with these huge, gorgeous, honey-scented that just, it fills the garden with huge white panicles of gigantic, gorgeous flowers. And you can get them in like very dark, almost black, feathery foliage, all the way up to green and light green. So it goes all year. Like this plant never looks bad. It comes up, it comes back every year, it comes back bigger. It can get to 7 feet in my garden, although more, you know, in other spots it might max out at about 3 feet. But I love black cohosh.
And now there are a lot of people who are listening or saying, well, wait a minute, I love the idea of that plant. What was that plant name again?
Yes.
So let's repeat that.
Yeah. Simisifuga ramosa. The common name would be bugbane or black cohosh. It really just became kind of popular on the market, I would say maybe 5 years ago. And it's still, I think, fairly hard to get up here, but if you go to garden centers, larger garden centers, I'm able to find as many as I like, and that's another one that divides politely. Like let it grow for at least 3 years in your garden, maybe even four, and then it will start sort of forming like bigger clumps, and then you just take that sharp spade, take a clump of it, plant it somewhere else. It gives just beautiful form, and I love the deep purple, the deep blacks, right? Kind of back to the doll's eyes creepiness. But just for contrast too, because you want contrast in a shady garden, because in a shady garden you don't have flowers all the time. So the deep purples with the lighter greens kind of give you that sense of interest in a perennial shady garden.
Where did this hour go?
I don't know.
It has flown by for me, and I bet it has for everybody else here. I want to thank you both so much for taking time to be with us today. Bruce Spangenberg is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. Erica Hanekel, former professor of environmental history at Northland College, master gardener, and her book, which I'm going to have to interview her about this book, is titled Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. We'll get her on for that. And coming up, we've got a whole lot more, a whole nother hour of garden talk in just a minute. I'm Larry Mealer.